In a moment, ABC News' Judy Muller, a veteran of many tough and important stories, will lead us in a spirited debate that was organized by Adam Glenn, a longtime SEJ member who has worked tirelessly and with great vision to make this session happen today. Our deep thanks to Adam. We will consider... We will consider whether the kind of heroism we saw in New Orleans was just merely a one-time, passing, nostalgic throwback to an imagined golden era, ultimately irrelevant now in a market-mad world, or whether it is still true today, as it was 100 years ago for Theodore Roosevelt, that far and away the best prize that life offers is the chance to work hard at work worth doing. Judy.
Thanks, Randy, very much for that eloquent introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here today, and I want to thank Adam Glenn as well for his tireless efforts. I got emails almost daily for the last few months. Very detail-oriented. It's wonderful. I have to say that when I first heard about the title for this, and they've been planning this for months, is journalism, environmental or otherwise, a dying idea? I thought, could be a short discussion, could be a depressing discussion. Then came Katrina. This is what we call a news peg. And as Randy already has told you, we will be looking at whether that is a one-trick pony in terms of turning journalism around, heightening its profile, or whether there are valuable lessons to learn from it, and I think the latter. We put together, Peter Dykstra, let me get all the names here because I want to credit everyone, Peter Dykstra, Marsha Walton, and Lee Huey of CNN, put together some clips from the Katrina coverage, and I think it's a nice little sampler to start with. We're not going to just talk about Katrina today, but it's a great way to kick off the discussion. And they put together some clips from Katrina coverage to kind of get us thinking about it. Let's roll it.
What has happened down here is the wind has changed.
You can hear people yelling for help. You can hear the dogs yelping, all of them stranded, all of them hoping someone will come. But for tonight, they've had to suspend the rescue efforts. It's just too hazardous for them to be out of the boats. There are electrical lines that are still alive. There are gas lines that are still spewing gas.
The river rolls all day. The river rolls all night.
It's hard for me to comprehend how many people might be out there and how many people's lives are in jeopardy or how many people may already be dead.
I want to thank you all and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
I got a baby. You know I have a baby. And you see, there are so many babies here. It's just not, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a question of objectivity, it's a question of reality. I don't know, man. I don't, let them walk out of here. Let them walk the hell out of here.
For the last 4 days, I've been seeing dead bodies in the streets here in Mississippi, and to listen to politicians thanking each other and complimenting each other, you know, I got to tell you, there are a lot of people here who are very upset and very angry and very frustrated, and when they hear politicians slap, you know, thanking one another, it just, you know, it kind of cuts them the wrong way right now, because literally there was a body on the streets of this town yesterday being eaten by rats because this woman had been laying in the street for 48 hours and there's not enough facilities to take her up. Do you get the anger that is out here?
Anderson, I have the anger inside of me. Most of the homes in my family have been destroyed. Our homes have been destroyed. I understand what you're saying, and I know all of those details. And the President of the United States knows those details. I'm not angry at anyone.
Over there, there's hope. Over there, there's electricity. Over there, there's food and water. But you cannot go from there to there.
I think
the government will not allow you to do it. It's a fact.
If I were living in New Orleans, I would be smart to be afraid of this hurricane rather than terrorists. They've had so many boy who cried wolf with these hurricanes that I think a lot of people stayed in their homes that shouldn't have. They don't have a way to warn people effectively because they're scaring us silly about everything that we encounter.
Bird flu,
mad cow,
right.
You name it, West Nile.
So what should we be afraid of? Because I am afraid. I am generally on a feeling of unease as though perhaps the world is made of sand. What should I actually be afraid of?
These leaders.
The ones that we have.
Right.
You get the sense that the media is... You ever see eight-year-olds play soccer? Where it's... They don't know really that there's positions. It's literally just like, oh, my God, ball. And then the ball, like, pops out over there, and they all go, ball. You know, they go, come in. That's the sense you get, that there's no discrimination. There's no discerning as to a strategy of attacking. Every risk is hyped at the same level.
We first learned of the convention center, we being the federal government, today. I've heard you say during the course of this evening on a number of interviews, you just found out about it today. Don't you guys watch television? Don't you guys listen to the radio? Our reporters have been reporting about it for more than just today.
We learned about it factually today, that that's what existed.
Somebody's coming to get you on Thursday. Somebody's coming to get you on Friday. And she drowned Friday night.
Oh, isn't it a shame?
Every person in that convention center, we just learned about that today. And so I have directed that we have all the available resources to get to that convention center to make sure that they have the food and water, the medical care that they need.
Sir, you're not telling me.
Those bodies that are there.
Sir, you're not telling me you just learned that the folks at the convention center didn't have food and water until today, are you? You had no idea they were completely cut off?
Paula, the federal government did not even know about the convention center people until today.
Yet, as scenes of horror that seemed to be coming from some third world country flashed before us, official Washington was like a dog watching television. It saw the lights and images, but did not seem to comprehend their meaning or see any link to reality.
Let's thank Peter, Marcia, and Lee. And now I'd like to invite the panelists to come up on stage, and we'll get going. We're going to conduct this something like a town meeting amongst ourselves first, and then about halfway through, we're going to open it up to the audience for Q&A. I'll say this now and remind you again before we get to that, that the first people to ask questions will be reporters and SEJ members, and after that, if we have time for anybody else in the public, I think there are some students here. It's always nice to have students here. We'll open up to you as well. There are microphones located in four places, and so when we get to that point, I will remind you that we want questions, not statements and speeches. I will feel free to interrupt you. Have I set a very clear tone? Is that a warm sort of way to welcome you to the auditorium? All right. Let me first introduce the panelists, and we are so lucky to have all these wonderful people. Jay Harris, to my far left, is my colleague at USC's Annenberg School. He's director of the Center for the Study of Journalism and Democracy. Ron Bailey, the science correspondent for Reason magazine. Merrill Brown, he is an industry consultant, as well as the national editorial director for News 21. That's Carnegie Knight's initiative on the future of journalism education. We've got Andy Revkin, reporter for the New York Times, B.B. Krause, environment editor for the National Public Radio folks, and an old friend of mine from CBS days, and Mark Schlefstein. See, I was determined to get it right. Schlefstein, with the Times-Picayune, environmental reporter. It's a wonderful panel. What I want to do right now is go down and ask each of the panelists to give a minute or less on their take on whether Katrina has changed the journalism landscape in any way. And just let me preface it with this. Certainly, in the immediate moment, this was a huge television story. As the only television reporter here, I feel that I should throw out a few numbers. For instance, Fox News' audience grew by 65% over the previous week during the Katrina coverage. CNN's climbed by 246% over the previous week. All of the major networks, we took on millions of viewers for this event. So clearly, there was a huge audience watching television. We know that. Whether it's got any staying power, whether we've learned anything from it, is yet to be seen. But let's start at the end with Jay, and we'll just work down, and I'm going to ask Mark to go last. Okay?
Thank you, Judy. Is the environment different? Are things different post-Katrina? Well,
I'm going to ask you to speak up.
It's closer? Okay, very good.
Real close.
Okay, now we got it. I would say that post-Katrina, there is reason to be hopeful. Reason to be hopeful because the people and the press have seen journalism work, because journalism has caused the government to do that which it should do, it was not doing. I think it's a different question as to whether or not there is a new opportunity as well. But I think it's an open question as to whether that opportunity for this rejuvenation of journalism in the public interest to be sustained, whether that opportunity will be realized. It seems to me that the forces working against that are powerful and persistent.
And we'll get back to you on that, too.
Generally, I agree with your analysis about that. I think that the reporting that we saw was fantastic in the sense that it actually got the government to react when it was failing in its jobs to do that. I don't think it represents a sea change for journalism, however. I think that we will go back to the old reactive kind of journalism. A disaster occurs and we start reporting on it. Sort out the guilty from the innocent, and there we are again. But there are a couple of questions I hope long-term they'll be addressed because of these particular things, particularly by environmental journalists. And first of all, one puzzle to me, it's always deeply, is whenever a government agency fails, we give it more money and more power. I don't understand. You don't do that anywhere else in the world, any other part of life. And then another question, which I really do think the country has to address, is that for the last 30 years or so, we've had a flood insurance program. Why should the government be subsidizing people to live in harm's way? And I think that that is an issue we have to talk about.
Merrill?
Thank you, Judy. I am not optimistic about the conventions of journalism as it's historically practiced by large institutions vis-a-vis Katrina. I am optimistic about the lessons of Katrina in how it demonstrates the empowerment that digital technology gives people and demonstrates, I think, clearly to both journalism institutions, to the public at large, and hopefully to people like those in this room who practice journalism, that there must be new ways to practice it for our craft and our business to be successful in the long term. Katrina, from a traditional journalism point of view, is just another big story. The Fox numbers or the hits on a web page numbers are just like any other big story. It reflects absolutely nothing in that regard, but reminds us again that we have a diffuse audience, that there are new tools the business and folks in this room, folks at this table need to embrace. And without a full embrace of digital technology and its opportunities, we're going to continue to see both business and readership decline in the journalism institutions we all know and respect.
Bebe?
I guess I have a mixed feeling about whether to be, I lean a little bit more being pessimistic about whether it really is going to change journalism. I think there's some questions. I was very impressed by some of the, you know, really push that colleagues made in terms of challenging federal officials. You saw some of it. Robert Siegel was out there, you know, Ted Koppel saying, what do you mean you don't know what's going on? But again, like Merrill says, it's a big story. And I think the press always jumps on big stories and always gets there. I think, as we know from Mark's work, I know Danny Zwerdling at our network had done, you know, some very deep reporting prior to this about the warnings, about the problems in New Orleans. The question will be, will we pay more heed to those kind of stories in the future? I don't know. I'd like to hope that we will in the wake of this. But at the same time, we see so many news organizations contracting resources that it's harder for them to do that kind of coverage. In my own organization, we are actually expanding our coverage, and that should be great. But at the same time, we are being pushed to go quicker, you know, shorter, not the kind of deeper kinds of reporting that I think we, you know, made our name on. So I don't know. You know, I'd like to be optimistic, but the jury's still out.
Okay, Andy.
Well, a lot of ditto initially. And I do think some of the norms of journalism, even in a story like this, are still getting in the way of portraying the situation the way it really is. And we still have the obligation to quote Mayor Nagin when he says tens of thousands of people are utterly dead or whatever. And so we still present a picture to the public that is highly imperfect. And then we still fail because of these norms, because we're covering it like this kind of story it is. We still often fail to get at the layers beneath. The institutional issues that led to the inundation of New Orleans are sort of like the non-point source pollution part of your beat. They're really boring, and they're about culture at the Army Corps of Engineers, and they're about how Congress works. I mean, this really starts with Congress. But I don't think we've successfully, you know, not yet at any rate, gotten at that side of the story. And then we'll go on, and I don't think this is going to be a sea change of any sort in the way we move ahead.
Mark?
Well, I'm sort of caught in a microcosm of everything that's been going on in the journalism world over the last 5 to 10 years, and it's finally come home to roost. My newspaper was pretty much insulated from the downsizing that was going on nationwide because we're privately owned. We're a new house newspaper. Well, now we're downsized. There's no question we're downsized, and it's a significant problem. We're trying to figure out what kind of newspaper we're going to be while at the same time dealing with everything that is going on, which is just amazing. And at the same time, we're also dealing with some of the great realities that have occurred as a result of this. I mean, the fact that my publisher comes into a meeting 3 days after the storm of the staff and says, you know, we are averaging 30 million hits on our affiliated website a day, and we don't have the Burbo cam. Isn't that wonderful? For us, that got the biggest round of applause of anything that happened in our newsroom. That was just amazing. So that's been useful. But we're also going to be facing similar sorts of problems in terms of just covering our beats. We're now going to be downsized as a newspaper, and there are so many huge stories going on in our town, and we don't have the resources to do it.
I want to follow up, Mark. You wrote in 1991 a four-part series, I believe it was called Louisiana in Peril, about the environmental dangers facing Louisiana. 1991, won a Pulitzer Prize, put it all out there. I'm wondering what it's like to be the Cassandra of the story of screaming from the rooftops only to see your own rooftop inundated. I mean,
Unfortunately, I have to correct you a little bit.
Okay.
The 91 series was sort of a baseline of the environment of Louisiana, and it was a finalist, but it didn't win the Pulitzer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But that's okay, but I appreciate that. I think what you're really referring to, though, was the 2002 series Washing Away, which talked about what really happened. I sort of like what my son calls me. He calls me Nostradamus rather than Cassandra. You know, that really has, it's been a very frustrating thing to have been covering this situation, knowing what was going to happen. Andy mentioned that the mayor said 10,000 people were, you know, there was a chance that 10,000 people were dead. We really didn't know at the point he said that whether or not that was true or not. And indeed, the next day I had some researchers come to me and say that there was a good chance there were 35,000 people who were still caught in the city, and it was really scary. But we haven't, you know, the death toll right now is 1,000 for the, you know, entire state. So it doesn't matter. It's too many. It's way too many. And the unfortunate thing is that I think we all bear a part of the blame. All levels of government, the newspaper, my newspaper, me personally, for not pushing to get more into the newspaper about what was going on and the fact that a lot of these issues were not being addressed. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
I want to come back to this line of thought in a minute, but first, the Times-Picayune, because it could not publish the traditional paper, went online, as you mentioned. And Tim Rutten of the LA Times, who's the media critic there, talked about it. And he said, the paper's online version offers not only an electronic front page with updated news stories, but also features for readers seeking missing persons, relief services, jobs, and even lost pets. It is at once broadly contextual in the way a comprehensive news report should be, and hyper-local in the way the immediate needs of the paper's readers demand. And I'm wondering, Merrill, if you see that as the format of the future.
Oh, I absolutely do. The newspapers who aren't willing to make the required editorial decisions and investments to become to their communities what the Times-Picayune was during this moment in time are destined to fail. And I mean fail in a significant way. I think there are large metropolitan dailies that won't move quickly enough to deal with community publications on the Internet, the certain reality of a guy named Craig Newmark in San Francisco, who in a townhouse invented Craigslist and ruined forevermore the classified advertising business. People who don't move quickly over the next few years and learn from the success of the Times-Picayune, albeit in tragic circumstances, are going to learn a severe lesson. And these tools, reaching out to the community, engaging the community, understanding new revenue streams, being aggressive about multimedia, they will be left behind by others who will fill the voids.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to put in one little bit, and I agree. I mean, we are getting a lot of pressure at NPR as well to put more on the web, but we're a really old medium. We're a really dead medium, supposedly, and our listenership has taken off. I mean, we've got, you know, what, 25 million listeners, and I still think people, if you're doing a good job, I just don't think newspapers are ever going to go away either. I think people just, if you're doing good work, they're going
to
come to
And just to respond to that, I agree completely about NPR's good work, but an NPR could not have been built during its heyday had it had to be done in the context of a large publicly held company, number one. Number two, it's created a new model that many of us should be looking at hard, which is about the support of both businesses, local institutions, and membership, which I think is also very critical. And its business model should be looked at very carefully and assessed by the same people that I'm referring to who have serious business and fundamental journalism problems.
Well, they also, they've increased their listenership by 60%, NPR has, since 1999. I mean, that is incredible. We would all love to have that kind of growth. Jay?
Judy, I'd like to make a point about the sort of mainstream media versus new media. It seems to me first that Merrill's point is inarguable about the fundamental nature of the digital future, and I think that we saw both in terms of what the Times-Picayune did and perhaps more importantly what average folk did, the importance of the Internet. That said, I think that which we were proud of as journalists when we watched the clip
that was put together was very much a product of mainstream media. This was a television story. Television took people there. It showed an undeniable truth to the people. It held government up to ridicule. And I do think we have to recognize that absent what television did and television's power, I don't think we would feel nearly as good about what journalism did in Katrina. Indeed, I don't think we would know as a people as much about Katrina.
It's interesting that this week is sort of Monday morning quarterback week in which we're looking now at stories that were actually hyped. There apparently were not rapes and murders in the convention center. This doesn't take away from the horror that was the convention center. And a lot of that information came from the police commissioner who was passing on some of these rumors. And now, as you say, the death toll is not in the thousands. And there are some other, now we hear that the police may have been looting as well. So a lot of later information coming in. I'm wondering, taking off from the John Stewart moments, which I loved, he was talking about the government like a soccer team going from one emergency to the other. But it seems to me that that applies to the media, too. It's pick up the ball and run to the next thing without any long-term coverage, without any foresight, without any post-mortem. I mean, does anybody else see it that way, Andy?
Well, just in our own coverage, I've been focusing a lot on the rebuilding story and on the how did we get here story, like everyone else is. And the things that the daily paper still ends up amassing, on the front page meetings, always end up pushing that stuff off to another day, to another day, to another day. We've had stories in queues that just sit there and may get in. Well, maybe that's more of a week in review story. It's a thumb sucker, you know. It's not a, and so that stuff doesn't get in. It doesn't compete. It doesn't compete with the search for the lost pets.
But do you think?
I mean, doesn't it?
I know the emotional stories get
or
in
the strippers.
First.
Remember, strippers were a big deal. You
know? Are strippers out of work? Oh
no, they were the first ones to come back.
Big daddies.
Well, they didn't have any clothes, so it worked.
Yeah. How much do you need, really? Okay. Oh, that's great. But do you think that there will be now more attention paid by editors to stories like Mark's 2002 and 1991 stories that predict, that look at what might happen? Because I know at ABC, I have to say, it's not easy to sell those. It's like, oh, another thing on global warming and what might happen. And if there's something more immediate that day, that, as you say, gets shelved.
Well, we've all, I bet you, I guarantee Mark at some point in his career has had an editor say to him what was said to me once in the mid-90s when I was covering the degradation of New York City's water supply. The reservoirs were slowly getting degraded. Isn't that a little ahead of the news?
Oh, it's
that's a direct quote from a top editor.
It's worse than that. When I was finally able to present the idea of doing the series, to our editors at a meeting to look at projects, the first thing that was said by an editor was, oh, that's just more Schlesstein's disaster porn. And my response, and I swear this is true, my response was, and it's really a problem, my response was, well, you know, just like real pornography, disaster porn is in the eye of the beholder. And there's 100,000 people who live in New Orleans who need to know that the city has no plans to get them out. And at that point, the editor said, well, you know, what we really want to do is a story about how everybody's ripping off FEMA and FEMA's ripping off everybody else. So go work on that for a couple of months and see if we've got something there. And which we did for 3 months while at the same time, John McQuaid and I, who was my partner on this thing, at the same time, we tried to reshape the story in a way that the editors would buy, and we came up with the idea of there's an incremental increase in the risk of a hurricane coming to New Orleans, and we were able to sell the story, finally. But that was, that, you know, and when you get back to why the editors were so concerned about doing it, it was for two reasons. One, oh, because everybody knows the city's going to flood, but nobody takes it seriously. And secondly, because... So let me get this straight. You want us to write a story that says that the newspaper is its future is going to be questioned, and the future of New Orleans is going to be questioned. Why would we want to put that in the paper? And now we know why.
Was that ever articulated by them, or was it always subtext?
Yeah, quietly in side meetings.
Spinning off what Andy said, too, is, you know, trying to get what's going to be in the front. And granted, I have not been in a newsroom since Katrina, but I know in my newsroom probably we were really lucky that Congress wasn't there. Because that's what happens with us. It's that Washington starts to lead and
on NPR?
Once you do the initial big story kind of coverage, and then it becomes what's Washington doing, so that getting those stories that Andy was talking about put in, and this to me goes with environmental coverage again, our leads are always somehow Washington, whatever they're doing trumps anything else that's a kind of background.
But isn't there a structural problem with news anyway? The fact of the matter is that readers actually don't want to read these long, and they're called thumbsucker stories. And the editors are very clear about this, you know. Basically, if you don't have an immediate disaster, who's going to read about it? The reason that CNN's numbers went up is because there were people possibly drowning, cats mm-hmm. drowning, whatever. And the problem is how do you get over that hump? And I don't see structurally in mainstream news how you're going to do that.
The question I have for you, Ron, is when you were talking about flood insurance and should we build in these places, now there's a skunk at the picnic story. And I'm wondering how hard...
I'm often delighted to be a skunk.
How hard would it be to sell that? By the way, should we rebuild New Orleans? Right. Should we rebuild these coastal communities with these... Should Trent Lott's house be rebuilt? Right. Should we all sit on the porch one day?
The answer would be no for Trent Lott. But.
Well, but I'm curious if you could ever sell that, because now the emotion is, we must rebuild. What if you ask the question, and a totally responsible question, maybe we shouldn't?
This is why the, in theory at least, unlimited digital news hole is so important. I mean, imagine that we're, as citizens, not getting access to important work about a moment in crisis by the reporters of the New York Times because they're constrained by their paper limitations. I mean, are we being served in that fashion? Don't the editors of the New York Times and other daily newspapers who spike stories or put them aside to the weekend, are they serving our needs by not publishing them when they have them? I think that tells us a lot about a variety of leaps that need to be taken here.
I'm going to disagree again and do so with stating at the outset my substantial respect for my friend Merrill. It seems to me that unlimited digital news hole is not an adequate solution to whether or not that story is in the A section of the New York Times, because I will state as a matter of firm belief that it's not the same thing in terms of the impact that it will have. But the day-to-day is important in every life except the life of a college professor, so let me step back for a moment and tell you as a former journalist what I hear listening to my colleagues. There is a venality now in the very heart of journalism institutions. We're listening to people talk about editors of some of our very, very best newspapers, some of the newspapers least affected by these, and NPR least affected by these things, who are really asking questions that should not be asked. That's the subject. I mean, it's almost as bad as the flood insurance question, the fact that these questions are being asked about. I mean, it's really sad to hear an editor of the New York Times or the Times-Picayune ask that question. I think the other question, though, that I would raise about the future is that, I mean, what's happening in journalism is going to continue to happen. It's insidious. It's corrosive. And I would argue that until there is an external demand for better journalism from readers, from the audience, to that complements the internal grief and despair among journalism, this process will slowly continue.
I do not understand why television, since I'm the only television person here, does not look at the NPR model and say, whoa, they grew their audience by 60% since 1999. Maybe it's because they're doing some good work, and people of all types are tuning in. It is not one kind of audience at all. And I don't understand why that is not seen. It's almost as though radio is invisible as a business model, and we've talked a little bit about that. But, whoa, instant access.
Although, ironically, as we've grown this audience, our big execs say, well, we're a primary news source for all these people, so we really need to change how we're delivering the news. And it's like, for me, why? Didn't they come because they like what we're doing? It's puzzling.
Let me give you the other side of that. And you know, as much as everybody wants to anoint the Times-Picayune as the only model of you know, somebody coming to the rescue of the people of New Orleans, there is another model out there, and it's Unity Radio, which is a combination of WWL AM radio, which was the talk radio station of New Orleans, and darn near every other radio station in New Orleans, all of which got together and are continuing to do 24-hour talk radio of the real kind, telling people what they need to know on a second-by-second basis. And it was, you know, it was important enough that when we were evacuating on the trucks out of our building going to Houma to try to find a new place to work, I'm listening to talk radio out of New Orleans that was still on the air, even though their building was flooding, and taking notes off of their interview with Aaron Broussard so I could get it up on our website as soon as we got to Houma. And that sort of thing was very important. It was a, you know, it's, you know, the greatest thing that could possibly have happened in New Orleans. Those sorts of decisions made by leaders in our industry. And unfortunately, I personally think that, you know, you can say that the audience needs to drive the way the news is going. Well, that ain't going to happen, I'm sorry, because the news is owned by people. And it's those people who need to decide where we're going.
There is one change that I'm wondering if it will stay. After 9/11, I saw a real sort of chilling effect in newsrooms about challenging administration officials. There was a mistaking, and I think Bill Moyers has said that, journalism for liberalism. Journalism for anti-patriotism by asking the tough questions. And I saw that change, and I wondered if there were, with Katrina, of course you couldn't help it, it was in your face. This wasn't WMDs we couldn't see, this was we could see it. But I wondered if there was a little get back there, first of all, and also if that will, you know, if it will stick, because you saw, you know, Anderson Cooper coming of age here, and a lot of other people really challenging people in the moment. Do you think that might be a lasting legacy?
I think there's less to it than there seems. I mean, it was hard not to criticize Michael Brown. But for me, the most hopeful moment in television, at least, has been David Gregory at NBC having the gumption to press the President of the United States, both on things that generally have not been asked because journalists have been unwilling to ask them. And he's also been willing to do it in a sort of Sam Donaldson sort of way, I mean, that without a great slam, when the president wanted to walk away. I mean, he had the strength of conviction to shout at him in a way that he could not ignore, are you going to get in the way? Is this merely an attempt to make yourself look better? And it seems to me that the real question of intimidation is in Washington. It's at the White House. I mean, the White House press corps, I think, has been particularly intimidated. And I think that's where you'll see whether or not there is a difference.
It's almost now as though everybody's competing to see who can be toughest. Now,
that would be a good thing.
Ron, what do you think of that?
Well, first of all, I make it a practice of talking to as few politicians as possible because they're not going to tell me anything that is not already on their press release. When I used to do a TV program, we basically figured you couldn't interview a senator for more than 15 minutes because he only knew 15 minutes about anything anyway. So that was the end of that. So I like talking to policymakers and in the sense of people who are actually in the think tank world, the universities, the science correspondent, I have that advantage over a lot of people. But I have been absolutely horrified at my friends in Washington who are so deferential to the politicians. It just amazes me. You know, yes, Senator, whatever, Senator. You know, and you beg them to talk to you. They should be coming to you. You shouldn't be running after them to try to get some stupid quote. And the problem is we set it up that the government now is at the center of our news. The rest of the country doesn't matter. Washington is like a giant black hole sucking in all of the talent and information in the country. And it's terrible.
Here's a question. Where was the press when Mike Brown was going up for confirmation? And I mean, I can't imagine our Washington Bureau assigning anybody to that, I have to say. But it's now that we see how important it is who goes into these jobs, I'm wondering if that will change. What do you think, Andy?
Well, I'm still stuck on what Ron was saying.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Which is correct. I have not been a Washington White House correspondent, but I got to go into the bubble once for a day when I covered Bush's speech on climate change in 2001 at NOAA headquarters, and it was very illuminating. I kind of went into the room, I got through all the security, and I was in the bubble, you know, and here comes this cluster, from including my newspapers people, and they kind of, the cameras all come in, they're like one organism, the White House thing. The White House thing. It comes into the room, the president makes his speech, that bubble leaves immediately with him because it's in the same motorcade going to whatever else they want to show those media people. And I walked out the front door, and there was this big demonstration by Greenpeace and all these other people outside about the... And that didn't get into any of the other coverage because the bubble didn't see it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just happened to walk out a different door, and there was reality. You know, there were actually people who didn't think the president's ideas were so great. And so we are, but as a paper, even, we are still totally focused on the Washington end of things. That's what got us in so much trouble on the WMD run-up, on anthrax. Those of us in the science team reporting on anthrax kept hearing things other than that this was some extra special super duper anthrax that Daschle got, you know, powdering his carpet, and that only a state could have made it. You know, they kept pushing that because that's what the White House wanted them to push. And I don't think we have learned those lessons yet. I mean, maybe right now it's a no-brainer because of all those TV pictures. Well, it's easy to beat up on the White House now.
Speaking of anthrax, I mean, I hate to go back to John Stewart again, but since he seems to be doing our job for us so often now. he did say, you know, mad cow. He mentioned all the other things that, you know, have terrified us. The media puts out there, oh, there's a cow dead in Canada. Stop eating hamburgers, you know. And all of this, is it a matter of crying wolf too much so that we when a hurricane's coming and this kind of thing, we don't react anymore because it's all the same?
Well, I do think that gets at getting back to the environmental side of journalism.
Good.
I mean, we all, this medium of environmental journalism grew up with the environmental movement, and it was always focused on a couple things, heroes and villains, you know, factories and factories aren't, no, let me get that right, ducks and factories would be the hero and villain, you know, the wildlife and the biologists. And we grew up on fear and loathing, on dread and danger, and now the picture is much more complicated. The things that will be the problems of the 21st century are not like the things that the Bhopals so much as the climate change. As I said earlier, non-point source pollution. There's 1.5 Exxon Valdezes going into our coastal ecosystems every year in America, but it's not some drunk sea captain, you know, and it's not good pictures. So we are part of the problem to that extent.
And let's face it, fear does sell. I mean, we all know the phrase.
For a while.
But the thing is, we can always come up with a new crisis. There's a whole industry of people out there who come up with crises for us. They can them for us. They come up with reports for us. It's ready made for us, and we can just take it and report it. And we do it very often.
And how many of us deal with, you know, environmental groups as a principal source? As you know, do you have as many sources in the broad spectrum of interests in any environmental issue? And you know, in some ways, the environmental groups are like tracking down the senators. I mean, they'll come to you. That's the difference.
Yeah.
But it's always that thing. Like, my job isn't to sort of sell your
no.
line. And I don't know. I think it's a particular challenge in environmental journalism. But I think it's one of our problems and how we're perceived as well.
Yeah. I guess I'm going to be Digital Boy on this panel and do it again. But The answer to this problem is engaging the public in a discussion about these stories that only digital technology can do. And if we were talking to people, and now we can, in ways that we never could before, through blogging and boards and various tools that we have, we can now get past all that and find out from the streets of America and from around the world more about what's going on than we ever could before. And if we learn to use this resource effectively, some of this Washington-centric stuff would go away, and our reliance on the conventions of organizations and government agencies would be broken down in a very significant way.
But how do you trust what you're getting?
Well, yeah.
Who are the bloggers? How do we know how representative they are?
How do you know what's in letters to the editor? You report on the tips and information and sensibility and issues that the public gives you.
Oh,
that's what we do as journalists.
Tool. It's absolutely a tool.
It's a tool.
But
that's
it's
all
not
I'm
like we're necessarily getting...
But the world is not just blogging. The fact of the matter is that, you know, Reason Magazine has, all public policy magazines have about 50 to 100,000 circulation, tiny, right, print circulation. But we have now literally millions of readers that we didn't have before, and we're still gatekeepers in a certain sense. And the other great thing about the blogging part is we have a blog called Hit and Run, where it's a vibrant community of people where anybody can say any idiot thing they want and do. And then, you know, they critique us, they critique the stories, they critique themselves. And we find that very, very useful.
I love it when New York Times recently reported that Brian Williams is now blogging during the day, telling you how he makes decisions, how the newsroom argues, you know, about, so it's sort of like you're getting the real dirt of what's going on to the newscast. And, of course, we know we're not getting all the dirt. Would that we could. There's probably somebody who could do that blog. But I thought, oh, my gosh. One more thing they're going to ask us to do. It's not enough we report during the day, but we've got to talk about how we're reporting during the day. I mean, this is so just really
much. We just had a round of meetings in the newsroom by our new grand poobah of things internet, John Landman, who's been moved into that role. And he's going section by section to infuse in us the idea that in this shrinking world, the Times is losing 500, the company, NYTCO, is losing 500 people, 45 in the newsroom on top of 25 who've already gone. And yet we are expected to do all those things, engage the public, accept more input, you know, be more productive, file